Hi, everyone. Welcome back to episode 55 of That's a Bad Sign.
This is a true crime podcast hosted every Thursday, except for last Thursday and some other Thursdays, but we try.
So we will start, as always, with Recommendation Corner, and you will kick us off, Liz.
I have a good one this week. I have been listening to a podcast called Radio Rental.
Okay.
It is interesting. It's basically people telling scary stories, but they happened in real life. So it's like 30 to 40 minute episode, and it's usually two stories. And it's just something really creepy that happened in their lives. Whether or not it's explained, it depends on the story. Some of it's paranormal. Some of it's creepy neighbors. And it's just like fascinating.
Any UFO experiences?
Not that I've heard yet, but I would not be shocked.
I have two recommendations because I'm selfish.
Okay.
My first one is for any New Yorkers who are listening or if anyone's planning on visiting New York City. I just went to a restaurant on the Upper East Side called Jojo. I don't know how to say his name. Jean George. It was so delicious. I think it's one of his newer restaurants and like really great prices, not astronomical. But I took my parents out there last night for their birthday and 5-star rating.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Always looking for new restaurants. I love that.
And then my other recommendation is the show called Evil. And I'm pretty sure it's network TV, which is weird. But it's streaming on Paramount Plus, which you can get a free trial of. It's about the Catholic Church in New York City and how they perform exorcisms. And it's all this like supernatural. And it's kind of scary. So if you run out of something to watch.
Both of our recommendations are creepy.
Oh, yeah. Mine's so creepy.
Oh, before we get into our story, we should give a shout out to our winner from our Instagram contest.
Yes. So last week we posted a Instagram competition and the winner received a blue hat that said tabs on it.
So shout out to our listener, Katie. We hope you enjoy the hat.
We'll be having another contest in the next few weeks. So everyone make sure to go follow us on Instagram.
Please.
Cheers.
Right. Let's do it.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
We always do our intro and then we sit and gossip for 20 minutes.
Yeah, refill the wine and then we start.
So back to the podcast. My sources today include an article from Tatiana 2417 on Medium, USA Today, and Fox News. This is the story of Brooke Schuyler Richardson. Brooke was born in Carlisle, Ohio, which is a small town with only 5,000 residents. And she was a popular cheerleader planning to go to the University of Cincinnati in the fall. She was in love with her boyfriend named Brandon, and they spent a lot of time together, and everyone, her friends and family, was happy for them. However, just like any other 18-year-old girl, Brooke had issues. Unfortunately, she was anorexic and had reportedly been anorexic since she was just 12 years old, refusing to eat gum at one point because she thought it had too many calories.
That is so sad, but sadly so typical.
Exactly. But when she began to date Brandon, her family notices that she starts putting on a healthy amount of weight. And for a girl with an eating disorder, that's a positive step in the right direction. Now, being sexually active, she asks her mom to go to the gyno with her for the first time ever so she can receive birth control. She goes into the office as her mom remains in the waiting room. And after her exam, she's told that she's pregnant and will be giving birth in about 10 weeks.
Oh my gosh. So she's pretty far along.
She immediately breaks down because she thinks she's too young to be a mom and she simply can't have this baby. And I mean, yeah. I would feel the same way and I'm 28 years old.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
Also, the worst part is the baby's not even her boyfriend Brandon's. It's her ex-boyfriend's.
That's a plot twist.
Just makes things a little more complicated. She asked the doctor, though, to give her the birth control anyway so her mom wouldn't suspect anything. So she leaves the doctor's office and goes into the waiting room. And she's clearly been hysterically crying. So her mom immediately realizes something's wrong. And she says, no, I'm fine. That was just really emotional going to the gynecologist. That's why I'm crying. Which makes no sense.
No. Anything but emotional, really.
So Brooke goes on with her life, acting as if nothing happened, not telling a single person, not Brandon, not her parents. She even goes to prom a few days after receiving her pregnancy news. And I think that just like shows up how she handled the situation. She said, I had 10 weeks, I'll figure it out, but I'm not telling anybody. I don't know if this is true, but I feel like I've heard that if you get pregnant younger, you usually don't put on that much weight and it's usually just in your stomach area.
Mm-hmm.
So you can wear baggy clothing, whereas if like you and I got pregnant, we'd like blow up.
Also, she's so tiny to begin with that it's, you know,
yeah,
people probably think she just gained a little bit of weight.
Exactly. A few months later, July 14th, 2017, the police knock on the Richardsons' door. They tell Brooke and her parents that Brooke's not in any trouble, but she just needs to go down to the station to answer a few questions. When she gets to the interrogation room, the police confront her and say, your doctor called. We know you had a baby. Where is it? And immediately, Brooke breaks down and confesses to everything. She said on May 7th, 2017, just 11 days after her appointment, she started having labor pains. Mind you, she thought she had 10 weeks.
Oh my goodness.
In the middle of the night, she delivered her baby alone in her bathroom, not waking up anyone in her home. Liz's mouth is just open.
I'm in shock.
She said the baby appeared stillborn and she even checked for a heartbeat and attempted CPR to bring the baby back to life. After realizing that nothing was working, Brooke went into her backyard and dug a small grave for the baby. She placed the grave in a spot she could even see from her bedroom window and then put a pot of flowers on top to mark the grave. So she tells the police all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Then Brooke is reunited with her parents. She apologizes for not telling them and even explains where the baby is buried. Finally, she tells them she named the baby Annabelle. So the police go to the family home and quickly obtain the baby's body and rush it off to the pathologist because the police are trying to determine, is Brooke telling the truth? Did she give birth to a stillborn baby? Or did she murder her own child? After the remains had been located and taken from the property, the Richardson family returned home. But then just 6 days later, the police called and asked Brooke to return back to the station for more questioning. When Brooke gets to the station, the police tell her that she's not in any trouble, but the pathologist report came back, and it says that the baby was burned.
Yikes.
And Brooke responds immediately and said, that's impossible. I didn't burn my baby. But hours after interrogation by three cops, without a parent or a lawyer present, Brooke's story starts to change. She says, like, actually, I did hear my baby gurgle when it was first born, but then it quickly died a few minutes later. So then I tried to burn it in the fire pit to cremate it, but that didn't work. So I buried it, but that's why it has burn marks. Never good at changing story.
No.
After that statement to the police, Brooke was charged with aggravated murder, which carries the life sentence in Ohio. And she was also charged with endangering a child and abuse of a corpse. When the trial starts, the defense tries to portray her as this naive, scared, and easily manipulated young woman who had a stillbirth and was coerced into confessing to murder. While, on the other hand, you had the prosecution who is painting Brooke as someone who cold-bloodedly killed her child. Is that a word? Cold-bloodedly?
Yeah, sure.
I don't think so, but moving on. Killed her child in cold blood because she was obsessed with external appearances and just wanted to remain the cool, skinny cheerleader. So I want to look into three big things when it comes to this trial, and it's the physical evidence, her confession, and third, her motive. So starting with the physical evidence, a second pathologist was brought in and did an analysis and found that the initial report was wrong and there were absolutely no signs of the baby being burned.
What? That feels like something that doesn't just get accidentally reported.
And when the new report comes out, the original pathologist recants her whole statement.
Oh, no.
So there goes any physical evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Next, her confession. The jury watches the confession tape and the defense just pokes holes throughout the whole confession because, one, it was just proven that the baby wasn't burned. And she admitted to burning the baby, which shows that she was just giving a false confession.
Right.
So it's like if she lied about that, she probably lied about the whole confession.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the jury is very much aware that she's an 18-year-old girl again, without a parent, without a lawyer, and three cops interrogating her.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
And I mentioned earlier that she admitted to hearing a gurgle from the baby, mm-hmm. and the prosecution lashed onto that, trying to prove that the baby was first alive. But when you watch the interview, it goes something like the detective looking at her and saying, "Are you sure the baby wasn't alive? You didn't even hear just like a little bit of a gurgle?" And Brooke responds, "Yeah, like maybe."
Okay. Yeah. So he's putting words in her mouth.
It's really not a powerful confession. If anything, it's highly suggestive on the detective's part, and the jury just sees right through it.
Mm-hmm.
So the defense is poking holes in her confession, and it's really not taken that seriously. And then last is motive. The prosecution saying that she simply didn't want to ruin her life with a baby, so that's why she murdered her daughter. But the defense highlights some interesting facts that contradict this motive. One being that she named her baby.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who's trying to act like this never happened wouldn't do that. She also buried it so she could see it from her window, even marking it with a flower. So it's like, why actually do a grave that you can see every night from your bed if this is something you just want to put behind you?
Mm-hmm.
Also, they highlight the fact that she's severely anorexic. So there's a good chance that that was the reason that she had a stillborn child. Also, the fact that she was told that she had 10 weeks to figure out her situation, but instead only gave birth 11 days later. The defense kind of used that to show that this is a young girl who went through a really emotional and tragic experience, who thought she had 10 weeks to prepare, and this was just kind of sprung on her.
Yeah, it's traumatizing. But on top of that, the baby was clearly very premature.
Exactly. Yeah, that's also a really good point. So in the end, the defense painted her as a confused child with a painful emotional experience just sprung onto her. And I think the defense did a great job of highlighting these points to contradict the motive. However, there is one thing that did not work in Brooke's favor, and those were her text messages.
Uh-oh.
The prosecution highlighted all of her text messages since giving birth. And the two that I thought were really not a good look for her were just a few days after she gave birth. She texted her mom, quote, "Yay, my belly is back." Not something you say after having a miscarriage.
No.
And then she also texted her boyfriend the night she gave birth, saying it was the worst night of her life. But then the next day, she told him that she felt so much better and that she is the happiest she's ever been. Again, not what you say after losing a baby.
Yeah, but I mean, that's someone who's clearly has so much emotional distress.
So, I don't know. In your opinion, do you think she should be found guilty?
This is a tough one. Is there no way that they could have found out if the baby actually was alive? They don't know.
They could not figure it out.
I mean, I don't think she should be getting life in prison, personally. I think she should be penalized in some way, but I think life in prison would be really severe.
I agree. And also, when I read this case, I just thought, I don't know if she killed her baby. Like, we don't know. However, in court, the prosecution did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
So on September 12th, 2019, after 4 hours of deliberation, the jury found Brooke Richardson not guilty on all major charges. However, since she buried the baby, she received a guilty verdict to gross abuse of a corpse, resulting in 3 years probation. So where's Brooke today? She works as a paralegal in her hometown, and she doesn't do much press. However, she did have one interview where she says that she feels like she's going to be haunted every day of the rest of her life for her actions.
Understandable.
So that's the story.
That feels straight out of a Law and Order SVU episode.
Oh my God. Yeah, it does.
There has to be an episode like that.
Just giving birth and not waking up your family? I find that insane.
Also, just cleaning it up after.
Oh my God. That just shows like how scared she was to tell anybody.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sad case any way you look at it. But at the end of the day, the evidence isn't there.
Yeah, and if you're going to let Casey Anthony walk, then you can't put this girl behind bars.
It always comes back to Casey Anthony.
Well, that's that.
Very, very interesting case, Em.
We will take a gossip break and then move on to your case.
BRB. I'm just going to tell you that it's a stalker case, and I'll give you my references.
kind of like you.
Well, that's what inspired me because I've been watching season 3 and it just led me to this story.
I am so excited. Let's go.
My references include crimetraveler.org, filmdaily.co, and thelineup.com. The year is 1980 and Dorothy Scott was a 32-year-old woman living in Stanton, California. She worked as a secretary for 2 different stores, but they were both owned by the same company. And they were both in Anaheim, California, just a few miles from her home in Stanton. She was single and had a 4-year-old son named Sean. And Sean's father didn't live close by, so while Dorothy was at work, her parents would babysit their grandson. According to pretty much everyone, Dorothy stayed away from drugs and alcohol. She preferred to stay in at night and she loved going to church. So, safe to say she was a homebody and she was really close with her family. She even lived with one of her aunts.
Her and her son lived with the aunt?
Yes.
Okay.
On the night of May 28th, 1980, Dorothy was at an employee meeting at one of her jobs.
Mm-hmm.
She noticed that her coworker named Conrad Bostrin looked a little bit ill. When she asked about it, he said that he had been experiencing some serious pain on his arm. And upon further inspection, they realized that he had a raised bump that looked to be some sort of a bite. And the pain was so severe that Dorothy offered to drive him to the U.S. Irvine Medical Center that was nearby. Another one of their colleagues named Pam also offered to go with them to the doctor. So around 9 p.m., Dorothy stopped by her parents' house to check on her son and to tell them that she would be late picking up Sean. So this was on her way to the hospital. While she was there, she changed from a black neck scarf to a red one that was a little bit warmer because it was getting chilly.
Okay.
When the 3 coworkers got to the emergency room, they were told that Conrad had been bitten by a black widow spider. So he was given a prescription and was discharged around 11 p.m.
That's terrifying.
I know.
That's my biggest fear.
Yeah, like not the point of the story, but also a huge concern. Dorothy told her coworkers that she was going to go pick up the car from the parking lot and that she'd come around and pick them up at the front of the hospital. So Conrad and Pam waited inside for a few minutes, but eventually they went outside to see if they could find Dorothy because she had been gone for kind of a long time.
Yeah.
That's when they saw Dorothy's white car speeding towards them, but it wasn't slowing down at all. They started waving their arms in an attempt to get her attention and say, "Hey, we're over here. Stop for us." But the car just sped past them.
That's strange.
And the headlights were so bright that they couldn't make out who was actually behind the wheel of the car, although they figured it was Dorothy. So obviously, as you said, this is really strange behavior. But Conrad and Pam thought maybe Dorothy's son had some sort of an emergency and she had to leave really quickly. Who knows? But hours later, they still hadn't heard from her. And the 3 of them were apparently very good friends. Mm-hmm. So at this time, they think something's wrong and they reported her missing.
After 3 hours?
It says a few hours. I'm not exactly sure.
I mean, good friends.
At 4:30 a.m., so this is what, 5 hours later, 5.5 hours later, Dorothy's car was found burning in an alley about 10 miles away from the hospital, but she was nowhere to be found.
No.
Police started working under the theory that Pam had been kidnapped by someone. And here's why. Prior to Dorothy's disappearance, she had started receiving really frightening phone calls from a mystery person. She mentioned to people that it was a male voice that sounded familiar, but she could never really place it.
How frustrating is that?
Yeah. At times, the caller would profess his love for Dorothy, and at other times, he would say he was going to harm her in unspeakable ways. He made it clear that he was watching Dorothy by recounting details of her day-to-day life. During one call, he told her to come outside because he had something for her, which is the scariest thing I've ever heard. But when she did eventually go outside, she found a single dead rose on the windshield of her car.
Oh my God, a dead rose.
Mm-hmm. So the calls obviously freaked her out and freaked her family out, but stalking wasn't really taken seriously back in the 80s. And to be honest, I don't think it's taken seriously enough these days. So they never even reported it to the police.
Oh, she didn't tell the police?
Mm-mm.
But her friends knew.
Yeah. About a week after Dorothy's disappearance, her parents began receiving unsettling calls from a man who they believed to be Dorothy's kidnapper. In his first call, he said something along the lines of, "Are you related to Dorothy Scott? Well, I have her." And then he abruptly hung up.
That is so horrible.
So sad. The man would call almost every Wednesday when Dorothy's mother was home alone, and the calls were never long enough for the police to be able to track them.
So do you think he was intentionally watching her and doing it when she was alone?
Mm-hmm.
Crazy.
He would say personal details about Dorothy's life, including things like the color of the scarf she was wearing the night she went missing. Remember I told you she changed into a red scarf?
Yeah.
So how many people would know that?
Yeah. Oh my God.
These phone calls haunted the family for 4 years, only ending once Dorothy's father started answering the phone, but only for a few months until the guy started to call again. Then a caller who they think is the same caller contacted a local paper who had written a story on the case, and he said, quote, "I killed her. I killed Dorothy Scott. She was my love. I caught her cheating with another man. She denied having someone else. I killed her."
Crazy person.
So the only lead that the police had in this case was this caller, and they couldn't track him. So the case pretty much went cold. On August 6th, 1984, Dorothy's remains were found on a remote construction site. So this is 4 years later, yeah. Her skull, pelvis, and thigh bones were found partially burnt, which helped the police with the timeline a little bit, because 2 years earlier, there had been a fire in that area, which meant that Dorothy's bones had been there at least that long. The discovery of her remains gave Dorothy's family a little bit of closure, although they still did not know who was responsible for her death. Dorothy's watch was found alongside her remains, and it had stopped at 12:32 a.m. on May 29th, which was almost exactly an hour after her coworkers saw her leaving the hospital parking lot.
Interesting. Oh, so maybe it became broken?
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
Her family held a memorial service for her on August 22nd, 1984, and they laid her to rest, but her son had to grow up without ever knowing what happened to his mother. Sadly, that is pretty much where the story ends.
No, Liz!
But I will get into a couple of minor Reddit theories.
I'm so sad.
So the theory in general is that she was kidnapped, which means the stalker had to have driven to the hospital. And Dorothy's car sped off, and people speculate that either he was driving the car and she was in the back seat, or that she was driving under his instruction because he had some sort of weapon, like a gun.
Yeah.
Either way, he would have had to come back for his car at some point. So I wonder if the police ever looked at surveillance cameras from the hospital parking lot. I don't know, but he had to have followed her to the hospital.
That would seem like a logical
right
next step.
There's another theory that this was around the time that the original Night Stalker was killing in California, and he apparently called some of the victims' families. People are on two ends of the spectrum on this. Some people are saying this, no way, that's not his MO, but other people are saying, actually, this could have been him easily because he may have changed his motive because he was close to getting caught, etc. Who knows?
But to stalk someone beforehand, I feel like the Night Stalker didn't really do that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe minorly, but this seemed like a pretty intense infatuation. The other question is, how did the stalker even know she was going to the hospital? It was not part of her daily routine. So could it have been a coworker? Those were the only people that knew where she was going, aside from her parents.
Were there any creepy coworkers?
Apparently, the police interviewed all of them and cleared them, but to me, that seems like a plausible.
Yeah.
Another weird situation is that the remains of a dog were found alongside Dorothy's remains. So people wondered, was this to throw off the scent of a cadaver dog, maybe? But other people thought this could have represented something bigger, like some sort of connection to the occult, which, as we know, coming off the 1970s.
I think that's a stretch. This person was stalking her.
Yeah. The last theory, was it a family friend? So when Dorothy's father answered the phone, the man stopped calling for months. And a lot of people think this is because they were nervous that the father was going to recognize their voice. To me, this seems like the most likely explanation because she was a young girl. And I feel like there's so many stories about, you know, parents, friends, or even uncles and, you know, things like that becoming obsessed and abusing younger women that they're close with.
Have they ever investigated?
There's very little from the police that you can read about on this case, which is terrible. So I don't actually know the answer to that. but I do know that both of her parents have passed away. However, her son is still alive and still trying to find answers about what happened to his mother.
Oh, no.
But it's just so sad because she was getting threatening phone calls. And even if she went to the police, I'm not sure they would have been able to, they would have done anything.
Yeah.
That's stalking cases are the scariest thing.
Oh, I hate that there's no ending.
Well, as I always say, if I do an unsolved case, I hope to one day be able to give an update.
All right.
Well, on that note, we already asked you to go follow us on Instagram. Please go write us a review.
Do we still have a Twitter?
We do have a Twitter. I'm very, I use it sparsely.
Okay, you don't have to follow us on Twitter, but Instagram, and yes, wherever you listen to your podcasts, please write us a review.
I think that's about it. Well, I'll talk to you guys next week.
Cheers.
Cheers.
We changed to White Claws.
They don't make the best clinking noise.